Chapter 3. Virus Hunting Takes Over. Traditionally, the scientist has been the creative individual who searched for simple explanations of seemingly complex phenomena. Copernicus and Galileo, for instance, reinterpreted the motions of planets in the sky, inferring that the Earth and other planets revolve around the Sun, not the Sun around the Earth. Newton puzzled out why apples should fall down and not in other directions and discovered the law of gravity. Koch found a method of proving when a germ causes a disease. Einstein seized on seemingly paradoxical behavior of light and proposed his theory of relativity as an explanation without having performed any experiments on the subject. Watson and Crick, who never experimented with DNA, took a second look at existing physical and chemical data and deduced the structure of the genetic molecule. Many pivotal contributions to science throughout history have consisted less of new observations than of new explanations for old data. Classical scientists did not view their occupation in terms of gathering data, but rather in terms of discovering the logical mistakes and simplifying the complexities of the prevailing explanations. Such work tended to wound egos and invited the anger of colleagues whose pet hypotheses had been sunk. But the scientific enterprise, in any case, achieved its well-deserved reputation for brilliant innovation. Because experimentation played such a limited role compared to thinking in classical science, the process was relatively inexpensive. Scientists labored nearly in obscurity, driven not by high stakes, politics, or finance, but by their own curiosity. Nuclear physicist Ralph E. Lapp, a prominent scientist who served as a researcher and advisor on the Manhattan Project, the Atomic Energy Committee, the Office of Naval Research, and other institutions, experienced science before and after the post-war transition. His early training had predated this change, allowing him to describe the classical situation. One has to have experienced these lean years in science to remember how frugally money was hoarded for research in physics. In those days, no scientist ventured to ask the federal government for funds. He gathered together what money he needed from private sources, or earned extra pay as a consultant to pay for his own research. But mostly, he acted as a jack-of-all-trades and built his own equipment. Graduate students were required to take machine shop practice and learn glass blowing. If he needed Geiger counters, he made them himself, and he wired his own electronic circuits. The physicist was the original do-it-yourself man on campus. When scientists found, as they did after the great crash on Wall Street, that new ideas demanded financial support for their exploitation, they did not think of asking the government to help. Funds to build cyclotrons and other expensive machinery of science were secured from private sources, generally from foundations, and the cost of operations was assumed by colleges, universities, and a few institutes. All other scientific fields, and indeed academic pursuit in general, faced the same conditions. The little federal money available went mostly into applied biology through the Department of Agriculture. But then came the Second World War, its immediate aftermath, and the Cold War. The detonation of two nuclear bombs over Japan, products of a program known as the Manhattan Project, violently brought science into public awareness. A team of scientists equipped with $2 billion had invented the new weapon in an around-the-clock engineering effort. This success was soon coupled with the onset of the Cold War, symbolized in the launch of Sputnik, the first artificial satellite. This Soviet propaganda coup terrified Americans, creating strong public support for crash science and engineering research efforts to catch up with the Soviets. The federal government moved to take advantage of this opportunity. The Atomic Energy Commission, formed in 1947, picked up the remains of the Manhattan Project and continued nuclear research. The National Science Foundation was established in 1950 and began disbursing grants for basic scientific research. In the years that followed, a bewildering array of federal science departments and agencies materialized to fund and monitor research of all kinds in government facilities, universities, and independent research labs. This new science establishment was modeled after the Manhattan Project's team-based investigation. Priorities therefore focused on the practical results of science, an appropriate goal for the engineering and technology-oriented research that first dominated the new federal spending programs. But recognizing that technology is the applied form of fundamental science, the government soon began throwing money at basic research as well, and thus transformed it into a bureaucracy. Creative geniuses were swept aside to make way for skilled administrators who led large teams of specialized technicians whose only strength was gathering ever larger quantities of raw data. Where nonconformist individuals once competed with only a handful of peers, they now faced opposition from tens of thousands of irritated colleagues, a crowd that could more easily drown out minority viewpoints. Experiments replaced contemplative thought and analysis, while research became dazzlingly high-tech and incredibly expensive. Just before World War II, total research and development funding in the United States, public and private together, amounted to approximately $250 million per year. By the mid-1950s, the federal share alone had grown to more than $2 billion, reaching $63 billion in 1989, and in 1993 becoming half of all research and development spending in the United States at $76 billion. Even adjusting for inflation, this federal spending figure has greatly outpaced the growth in our national economy, becoming 1.25% of the entire gross national product by 1989. Federal research money has turned into the major funding source for universities and other institutions, expanding and reshaping departments in its wake. President Eisenhower summarized the emerging problem well in his 1961 farewell address. "Today, the solitary inventor tinkering in his shop has been overshadowed by task forces of scientists in laboratories and testing fields. In the same fashion, the free university, historically the fountainhead of free ideas and scientific discovery, has experienced a revolution in the conduct of research. Partly because of the huge costs involved, a government contract becomes virtually a substitute for intellectual curiosity. For every old blackboard, there are now hundreds of electronics computers. The prospect of domination of the nation's scholars by federal employment, project allocations, and the power of money is ever present and is gravely to be regarded." Ironically, Eisenhower had previously declared in 1957 that shortages of trained manpower exist in virtually every field and had pushed for rapid production of more scientists. This supposed PhD shortage defined the basis of an important part of the explosive federal spending, a portion of which was devoted exclusively to the subsidy of graduate students and postdoctoral fellows to work in scientific fields. Universities, especially their science departments, became little more than factories turning out new doctorates as quickly as possible. The results have been predictable. When the American Association for the Advancement of Science was established in 1848, it had 461 scientists as members. It then reached 36,000 members during World War II and already passed 100,000 during the 1960s. Today, it boasts some 135,000 members and is only one of many growing science associations. The National Academy of Sciences, in which membership even today is a unique honor reserved for a few scientists, started in 1863 with 50 members. Those ranks swelled past 600 by the 1960s and now stand at 1,650. The total number of science doctorates awarded each year has increased from under 6,000 in 1960 to nearly 17,000 in 1979. By the mid-1980s, the ranks of PhDs and MDs working in science or engineering had swelled to 400,000, a figure that for decades has grown much faster than national employment. As a result, of every 8 scientists who ever lived in the history of the world, 7 are alive today in 1969. Similar statistics would hold today. Nor has the pressure for further expansion abated until very recently, as evidenced in a 1990 policy statement of the Association of American Universities referring to an impending PhD shortage. Only in October 1995 did science for the first time begin to worry about the imminent American PhD glut. Yet we cannot find among them the 8 modern Galileos, Planck's, Einstein's, Koch's, Pasteur's, or Mendel's that these statistics predict. Increasing numbers of scientists means many more papers being published in scientific journals, with the publish or perish stakes rising constantly. According to one summary, the first scientific journal began publication in 1665. By 1800, there were 100 journals. By 1900, 10,000 journals. Today, 1969, over 100,000. By 1986, an unreadable total of nearly 140,000 papers were being published each year just by U.S. scientists, about one-third of the world total. Such overgrowth in scientific ranks produces regression to the mean. Competition among large numbers of scientists for one or a few central sources of funding restricts freedom of thought and action to a mean that appeals to the majority. The scientist who is very productive, most able to sell research, and well-liked for not offending his peers with new hypotheses and ideas, is selected by his peers for funding. The eccentric, absent-minded professor with crazy ideas has been replaced by a new breed of scientist, more like a yuppie executive than the quirky genius of old academia. These peers cannot afford a nonconformist or unpredictable thinker because every new alternative hypothesis is a potential threat to their own line of research. Albert Einstein would not get funded for his work by the peer review system, and Linus Pauling did not for his work on vitamin C and cancer, even though he received 2 Nobel Prizes. The only benefit of the numerous cascades of competitive tests and reviews set up by peer review is the elimination of unsophisticated charlatans and real incompetence. In sum, the review of too many by too many achieves but one result with certainty: regression to the mean. It guarantees first-rate mediocrity. As these armies of new scientists flood the peer review system, they even act to suppress any remaining dissension by the few remaining thoughtful researchers. Peer review, after all, can never check the accuracy of experimental data. It can only censor unacceptable interpretations. A scientist's grants, publications, positions, awards, and even invitations to conferences are entirely controlled by his competitors. As in any other profession, no scientist welcomes being outcompeted or having his pet idea disproved by a colleague. Former science editor Dr. Philip Abelson presciently described the pressures against dissenters who raise questions publicly. The witness in questioning the wisdom of the establishment pays a price and incurs hazards. He is diverted from his professional activities. He stirs the enmity of powerful foes. He fears that reprisals may extend beyond him to his institution. Perhaps he fears shadows, but in a day when almost all research institutions are highly dependent on federal funds, prudence seems to dictate silence. Few scientists are any longer willing to question even privately the consensus views in any field whatsoever. The successful researcher, the one who receives the biggest grants, the best career positions, the most prestigious prizes, the greatest number of published papers, is the one who generates the most data and the least controversy. The transition from small to big to mega science has created an establishment of skilled technicians, but mediocre scientists, who have abandoned real scientific interpretation and who even equate their experiments with science itself. They pride themselves on molding data to fit popular scientific belief, or perhaps in adding non-threatening discoveries. But when someone strays outside accepted boundaries to ask questions of a more fundamental nature, the majority of researchers close ranks to protect their consensus beliefs. Biology now constitutes about a third of the total basic science in this country, and about half of all academic research, far larger than physics, engineering, mathematics, social science, or any other field. Biology's dominance of research has resulted naturally from a massive infusion of federal funds, mostly through the National Institutes of Health, NIH. Formerly a backwater agency buried inside the Public Health Service bureaucracy, the NIH has since the 1950s developed a voracious appetite for money. Its 1955 budget hovered somewhere around $100 million. Today, it spends closer to $10 billion. NIH research grants not only fund some in-house labs, but they now provide the basic source of funding for universities and other institutes, including research conducted in other nations. Half the total federal research spending on universities and colleges, for all subjects combined, is now provided by the NIH. So while academic institutions formerly provided their own limited monies for research, NIH grants have now become a major source of income for the larger and increasingly dependent universities. According to a 1990 article in the Journal of NIH Research, when NIH sneezes, it is the academic community that catches cold. As both funding and conformism increase, one would expect the potential for disastrous mistakes to increase as well. The new money in biology was grafted on to an establishment long dominated by microbe hunters. Despite the disappearance of infectious plagues, therefore, both bioscience and popular culture have entered a new, revived era of microbiology, now in the form of virus hunting. Because biology is also the foundation underlying medicine, a mistaken hypothesis must inevitably lead to human tragedy. This happened when the successful war on polio, the last triumph of the germ theory, was extended to the misdirected war on cancer and then climaxed in the failed war on AIDS. Because virus hunting won the war against polio, victorious virus hunters continued to march against cancer and AIDS with the same concepts, but not with the same success. From early virology to polio. Unlike bacteria, protozoa or fungi, viruses are not living microorganisms. Whereas bacteria are single-celled creatures, viruses are much smaller and cannot grow on their own. Composed typically of protein and either DNA or RNA, the genetic molecules, virus particles must infect living cells, tricking their new hosts into producing large numbers of viral molecules, which are then assembled into new viruses like cars on an assembly line. Only by this means do viruses survive and go on to infect new hosts. While countless different viruses exist in the world, each can infect only a limited range of living hosts, and then only specific cell types within the host's body. Every category of living organism, whether animal, plant, or bacterium, is susceptible to infection by some of nature's viruses. The early microbe hunters began accidentally finding viruses while searching for bacteria. During the 18th century, Edward Jenner gained fame for his discovery that humans could be immunized against smallpox by injecting material from cowpox. Jenner could not know that he had used a virus, much less what a virus was, and he lived decades before anyone even proposed bacteria to be disease-causing. When Louis Pasteur turned to rabies research in the early 1880s, he correctly discovered that the disease could be transmitted from one animal to another through its saliva, but was astonished that he could never find any guilty bacterium. Pasteur guessed the cause to be a bacterium too tiny to see even in the microscope. In fact, this was also a virus. Pasteur then became the second person to invent an immunization, this time for rabies. Not until 1892 did anyone perform the first actual isolation of a virus. Russian bacteria hunter Dmitry Ivanovsky gathered fluid from tobacco plants suffering the mosaic disease. He passed this liquid through a filter so fine that the pores allowed no bacteria through. Yet to Ivanovsky's surprise, the bacteria-free filtered liquid easily made new plants sick with the disease. This observation was repeated independently by the Dutch botanist Martinus Willem Beierink in 1898, who recognized that the invisible cause was indeed some altogether different kind of infectious agent. He coined the term that led to the microbe's name, tobacco mosaic virus. In the same year as Beierink's report, two German scientists purified a liquid containing filterable viruses that caused foot and mouth disease in cattle. Walter Reed followed in 1901 with a filtrate responsible for yellow fever, and soon dozens of other disease-causing viruses were being found. The next logical step was to determine what viruses really were. American chemist Wendell M. Stanley accomplished exactly this in 1935 when he created pure crystals of tobacco mosaic virus from an infectious liquid solution. Having these crystals allowed him to study their structure, and he discovered that these crystallized germs could still infect plants with no trouble, In other words, the virus was not a living organism since it could be crystallized like salt and yet remain infectious. Soon he and other scientists began routinely crystallizing many different viruses. In 1946, Stanley received the first Nobel Prize ever awarded to a virologist, and 2 years afterward established the virus lab at the Berkeley campus of the University of California, where he later supervised the training of Harry Rubin, Peter Duisberg, and other scientists in virus research. While viruses were joining the ranks of sought-after microbes, the political institutions that would revive microbe hunting after the Second World War were developing. Congress had in 1798 formed the Marine Hospital Service for the medical treatment of sailors, an agency that was renamed and expanded in 1912, right in the middle of the microbe hunting era. This new public health service received a mandate to investigate and cure human disease, inevitably focusing on contemporary contagious or suspected contagious diseases like pellagra. This bias for infectious disease had been reflected in the name of a small subdivision created in 1887, the Hygienic Laboratory, which itself was expanded in 1930 and renamed the National Institutes of Health, NIH. True to form, the medical experts trained by and hired into these structures could think of no other way to fight disease, and they avidly pursued their one skill right on through both world wars. Even Joseph Goldberger, who discovered that a vitamin deficiency caused pellagra, had spent his previous 14 years with the Public Health Service chasing microbes. But as infectious plagues gradually disappeared, microbe hunting not only interfered with the genuine scientific challenges of non-infectious diseases, it also determined unsuccessful, if not disastrous, strategies against diseases that proved to be non-infectious. Indeed, the victorious war on polio, the last of the serious contagious epidemics of the industrialized world, became the very model for the failed wars on cancer and AIDS. Polio had always been, and is still throughout much of the Third World today, an awesome illness. Though often fatal, the disease was best known for causing paralysis, and it tended to strike children most commonly. President Franklin Roosevelt, perhaps the most celebrated polio case of all time, in 1938 set up the Private National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, NFIP, to conquer the dread disease. The impetus provided by the foundation led many key scientists to research poliovirus, as did the sudden, frightening polio epidemic that exploded in the Western nations, brought home by troops returning from the Pacific Theater in 1945. The virus was first isolated as a filtered liquid in 1908, but as with all viruses, no one could make these non-living entities grow outside the body. To produce an effective vaccine, the virus had to be produced in a laboratory. Dr. John Enders and two co-workers stumbled on a means of doing so in 1948 by growing the virus in cells cultured from human placentas cast away at birth. A Nobel Prize was awarded to all three researchers a few years later. In 1955, Wendell Stanley first crystallized the polio virus in his Berkeley lab. The major medical lesson of virology had long been that antibiotics which kill bacteria are completely useless against viruses. But immunization had been tested since the time of Edward Jenner in the late 18th century and proved to be the only effective technique against viruses. Vaccination works by introducing a weakened or inactivated form of a virus into the body, causing the body's immune system to produce a reserve supply of antibodies against the virus. In theory, if the real virus later infects the body, antibody proteins stand ready to attack the germ. Now that poliovirus could be grown in cell culture, a vaccine became more feasible. Two groups of researchers had already tried making vaccines from viruses grown in monkeys, but vaccines accidentally caused polio in several children during their 1935 trials. The first to try a vaccine from virus grown in cell culture was Dr. Jonas Salk, who worked for the NFIP. Salk used chemically inactivated viruses in a nationwide field test during 1954, with 400,000 children receiving vaccinations. After the results came in, the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, HEW, officially licensed the vaccine the following March. With this stamp of expert approval, all public apprehensions dissolved and the NFIP moved immediately to begin universal distribution. The NFIP even lobbied for federal money to provide free vaccine to the poor, but fortunately did not succeed, for within weeks, reports came pouring in of children who were becoming paralyzed from the vaccine itself, which contained rare virus particles that had survived the inactivating treatment. In other words, fully active poliovirus had been injected directly into the bloodstreams of many children. More than 200 people were hit with vaccine-induced polio the summer of 1955, including 11 who died. Public celebration turned to horror. The disaster forced vaccine production to stop, and within 3 months, a complete political shakeup hit HEW. The secretary resigned, as did the director of the NIH and various other officials. The vaccine was restarted only after screening procedures were tightened, and later another type of vaccine replaced the Salk version altogether. On August 1st of 1955, at the time of the Salk vaccine disaster, James Shannon was promoted to director of the NIH. A disciplined and intensely ambitious man with a PhD in physiology, Shannon was known to his associates for his aggressive, even ruthless leadership style. He had developed grand notions of how science should be restructured through a central authority. The Salk vaccine fiasco handed Shannon the opportunity to refashion a small-time agency into the largest biomedical research establishment in human history. As he retrospectively described his view, the main deficiency preventing progress was the inadequate funding of research. The difficulty seemed to be in the scaling of the system. There were manpower and resources, but they were too modest in size because of the inadequacy of support funds. It was his profound conviction that an expansion of the science base for medicine was needed, doable, and should be undertaken with a sense of urgency. Shannon's aims were well planned and quite specific. Success was only possible by breaking out of the confines of the then federal budget for the support of the biomedical sciences. A realistic program would have to provide a continuing expansion of the base for scientist production and an expansion of physical resources to house the expanding programs. The target seemed clear. He set about immediately to consolidate his support in both houses of Congress. The chairman of the House Appropriations Committee, John Fogerty, and his counterpart, Senator Lister Hill, became Shannon's close allies in his bid to spark explosive funding increases for the NIH. With their help and the backing of the Eisenhower administration, Shannon successfully doubled the 1956 NIH budget to $200 million for fiscal year 1957, by far the most radical increase in the agency's long history. He continued expanding the NIH until he retired in 1968, by which time the agency's annual budget exceeded $1 billion. The NIH's growth has continued without let-up to this very day, its annual spending of more than $15 billion now making it the powerhouse of biomedical and academic research establishments. Shannon wanted the NIH to create a huge infrastructure for basic research, but he knew that Congress and the public worried more about the practical questions of human disease. Using the Manhattan Project and the space program as models of heavily funded enterprises built during World War II and the Cold War, he organized basic research for wars on disease. Shannon had always disliked the NFIP and the Salk vaccine program for having been funded mostly privately rather than under tight federal control, so he began spending the new NIH's funding and taking over polio research in the United States. His war on polio provided grants that trained a growing field of scientists in studying viruses. This growing virology program meshed well with the microbe hunters who had long dominated the NIH and helped revive their dwindling fortunes. When Shannon turned to creating a war on cancer over the next several years, the virologists became his frontline soldiers. And when the NIH got involved in the war on AIDS in the 1980s, virus hunters again took charge. Many of the leading scientists in the war on AIDS, such as David Baltimore and Jonas Salk, launched their careers in the wake of the NIH war on polio. Since the polio epidemic disappeared in the early 1960s, no other catastrophic infectious plague has struck the industrial nations. Cancer and heart disease have become the prominent examples of non-infectious diseases, mostly affecting those of older age, to which medical science has had to turn for employment. But with Shannon's legacy of a reshaped NIH trapped in a virus program of its own making, microbe hunting was rescued from scientific obsolescence and now has a political stranglehold on research. Slow viruses, the original sin against the laws of virology. From the discovery of tobacco mosaic virus through the polio epidemic, scientists have found and legitimately blamed many viruses for a variety of diseases, each having passed the acid tests of Koch's postulates. But for every truly dangerous virus, many more perfectly harmless passenger viruses can be found in humans and animals. NIH-sponsored polio research during the late 1950s proved the point. Researchers trying to isolate new strains of poliovirus accidentally found numerous closely related passenger viruses, such as Coxsackie and echoviruses, that, like polio, infected the digestive system. Scientists classified some of these viruses as orphans, viruses without corresponding diseases. The virus hunters could not bring themselves to believe microbes could exist without being harmful and expected even these orphan viruses would someday find appropriate sicknesses. When trying to blame a passenger virus for a disease, however, one nagging problem haunts the virus hunter. The laws of virology dictate that the illness will strike the victim soon after infection. When microbes infect a new host, they cause sickness within days or weeks at most. In order to cause disease, viruses need to grow into sufficient numbers to take over the body. Otherwise, the host's immune defenses will neutralize the invader and prevent disease altogether. The rate-determining step of such fast, exponential growth is the generation time of the virus. Since the generation time of all human viruses is between 8 and 48 hours, and since the infected cell produces 100 to 100,000 viruses per day, viruses multiply exponentially, increasing in numbers 100 to 1,000-fold per day. Within a week or two, 100 trillion cells can be produced, one for each of the 100 trillion cells in the human body. Therefore, if scientists wish to convict an innocent virus, they must invent a new property for it that allows the virus to violate the laws of virology. For example, they can hypothesize a latent period of months or years between the time the virus invades the body and the appearance of symptoms, hence a slow virus. However, the slow virus concept has never been reconciled with the short generation time of viruses and the immune system. Once the virus lies totally dormant, an intact immune system will never allow any virus to be reactivated to multiply into numbers that would threaten the host. For a virus to be reactivated, the immune system first must be destroyed by something else, the real cause of a disease. A reactivated virus would just contribute an opportunistic infection. Thus, there are no slow viruses, only slow virologists. A conventional virus could, however, be slow-acting in a defective immune system. Indeed, some exceptional victims suffer pre-existing health problems that prevent their immune systems from reacting decisively against the virus, allowing it to continue growing and damaging the host for a long period of time. This can happen with virtually any type of virus, but it is extremely rare. When such a chronic infection does occur, as with a small percentage of hepatitis cases whose immune system is damaged by alcoholism or intravenous drug addiction, the virus keeps growing abundantly in the body and can easily be found by experimental tests. Other germs, like herpes viruses, can hide out in some recess of the body, breaking out periodically to strike again when the immune system passes a seasonal low. In both examples, only the weakened immune system of the host allows the infection to smolder or occasionally reappear from hibernation. By contrast, a slow virus is an invention credited with the natural ability to cause disease only years after infection termed the latent period, in previously healthy persons, regardless of the state of their immunity. Such a concept allows scientists to blame a long neutralized virus for any disease that appears decades after infection. The slow virus is the original sin against the laws of virology. The slow virus or latent period concept now used to connect HIV with AIDS can be traced back to the days of the war on polio. The researcher who popularized this modern myth is today an authority for AIDS researchers, and one whose career epitomizes the evolution of the virus hunters over the past three decades. Dr. Carlton Gajdoszczyk is a pediatrician who has worked as a virologist at the NIH for decades, having spent a great deal of time studying contagious childhood diseases around the world. Gajdoszczyk was sponsored by the NFIP and sent to New Guinea in 1957. There, a doctor with the local health department introduced him to a disease called kuru, a mysterious ailment that attacked the brain, rendering the victim increasingly spasmodic or paralyzed until death within months. The syndrome existed only among the 35,000 tribal villagers in one set of valleys, mostly the Four tribe. Before Gajdoszczyk's arrival, no outsider had ever described kuru, although the Four tribesmen told him the condition had begun appearing a few decades earlier. Gajdoszczyk's initial study assumed the disease to be infectious. He reported that the natives routinely cannibalized the brains of relatives for ritual purposes, a practice that they told him had begun around the same time as the arrival of kuru. Gajdoszczyk later explained to one interviewer that cannibalism expressed love for their dead relatives and that it also provided a good source of protein for a meat-starved community. Gajdoszczyk decided that kuru was transmitted by the eating of deceased victims' brains. Yet when he searched for a virus, he ran into a baffling absence of evidence. None of the typical signs of infection could be found in the patients. Their bodies showed no inflammation and no fever. No changes were registered in their supposedly infected spinal fluid. Their immune systems failed to react as if any microbe had invaded the body, and those people with suppressed immune defenses had no greater risk of catching the disease. Another scientific group soon arrived from Australia and concluded that kuru might be genetically inherited. Upon arriving back in the United States, Gajdoszczyk was hired by the NIH to work at its Institute for Studying Neurological Disease. While continuing to monitor kuru incidents, he devoted his time to laboratory study of the condition. Word of his discovery of kuru meanwhile made its way to England, where another virus hunter was investigating a sheep disease known as scrappy, which involved symptoms of brain degeneration. The English researcher suggested to Gajdoszczyk that kuru might be caused by a slow virus, one with a long latent period. Gajdoszczyk was immediately hooked by the revolutionary idea, despite its own misgivings that genes, toxins, or nutritional deficiencies might be the cause of kuru. Again determined to find an elusive virus, he tried to transmit kuru from victims to chimpanzees. But none of the animals became sick when injected with blood, urine, or other bodily fluids from kuru patients, nor from the cerebrospinal fluid that surrounds the brain, which should have been full of the alleged brain-destroying virus. Indeed, the monkeys contracted no disease even from eating kuru-affected brains, the authentic animal model of cannibalism. Only one bizarre experiment did work, in which the brains of kuru patients were ground into a fine mush and injected directly into the brains of live monkeys through the holes drilled in their skulls. Ultimately, some of the experimental monkeys suffered coordination and movement problems. Surprisingly, though, even this extreme method could not transfer kuru to dozens of other animal species. And no virus could be seen in the brain tissue, even using the best electron microscopes. At this point, one might expect Gajdoszczyk would have suspected something was seriously wrong with his virus hypothesis. If evidence for the invisible virus could not be found anywhere but in unpurified brain tissue, if it did not elicit any defensive reactions by the body, and if it could not be transmitted in pure form to animals, then probably no virus existed at all. The homogenized brain tissue of dead kuru patients, full of every imaginable protein and other compounds, should in itself be toxic when inoculated into monkeys' brains. Nevertheless, the sick monkeys convinced Gajdoszczyk and his colleagues he had found a virus. Since he could not isolate it apart from the brain tissue, he decided to study the virus and its structure with a standard experiment. He would define which chemical and physical treatments would destroy the microbe, thereby gathering clues about its nature. But to his astonishment, almost nothing seemed to harm the mystery germ. Powerful chemicals, acids and bases, boiling temperatures, ultraviolet and ionizing radiation, ultrasound, no matter how he treated the brain tissue, it still caused kuru in his lab monkeys. Further tests also proved that no foreign genetic material, which all viruses require for their existence, could be found anywhere in Kourou-affected brains. Employing the strongest virus-destroying treatments, Gaidashek had failed to render the Kourou brain tissue harmless in his experiments. His results lent themselves to one obvious interpretation. No virus existed in the first place, so it could not possibly be destroyed. But Gaidashek clung to his virus hypothesis. Despite his disappointing experiments, he turned the results upside down and argued that the Kourou virus was actually a new type of supermicrobe, or as he put it, an unconventional virus. This new virus also needed to act as a slow virus, since long periods of time elapsed between an act of cannibalism and the onset of Kourou. He liberally suggested latent periods extending into years or even decades. At an earlier time, and in another context, Gaidashek probably would have been ignored by orthodox scientists. But he offered this hypothesis to a generation of scientists dominated and impressed by virus hunters. The year was 1965, polio had largely disappeared, and the burgeoning ranks of NIH-funded virologists welcomed any new research direction on which to use their skills. Thus they embraced Gaidashek's slow virus hypothesis enthusiastically. They listened uncritically when he claimed a similar unconventional virus caused Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, a rare brain disorder that seems to strike mostly Westerners having undergone previous brain surgery. Obviously, such medical operations might well be suspected as the real cause. Gaidashek proposed slow or even unconventional viruses as the causes of a huge laundry list of nerve and brain disorders, ranging from scrapie in sheep to multiple sclerosis and Alzheimer's disease in humans, and he was taken seriously even though he offered no proof. Entranced, his peers awarded him the 1976 Nobel Prize for Medicine, specifically for the Kourou and Creutzfeldt-Jakob viruses he has yet to find. And the NIH promoted him to head its Laboratory of Central Nervous System Studies. In the meantime, another crucial, if embarrassing, bit of information has emerged as a challenge to Gaidashek's virus Kourou hypothesis. The published transcript of his Nobel acceptance speech in a 1977 issue of Science magazine included a photo ostensibly showing New Guinea natives eating their cannibalistic meal. The photo is not very clear. When colleagues asked Gaidashek if the photo truly showed cannibalism, he admitted the meal was merely roast pork. According to science, he never publishes actual pictures of cannibalism, he says, because they are too offensive. Unconvinced, anthropologist Lyle Stedman of Arizona State University had investigated and directly challenged Gaidashek, claiming there is no evidence of cannibalism in New Guinea. Stedman, who spent 2 years doing field work in New Guinea, noted that he often heard tales of cannibalism, but when he probed, the evidence evaporated. Gaidashek, angered by the hint of malfeasance, has insisted that he has actual photographs of cannibalism, but he would never publish them because they so offend the relatives of the people who used to do it. This statement contradicts his earlier claims that the tribesmen proudly ate their dead relatives out of respect, quitting the practice only in deference to outside pressure from government authorities. For evidence of cannibalism, Gaidashek also cited Australian arrests of tribesmen for the alleged crime, which, as it turned out, were based on hearsay accusations. So perhaps New Guinea natives stand falsely accused of ritual tribalism. In addition, few people outside of Gaidashek's original research team have ever personally witnessed Kourou victims. This means we also depend on his own descriptions and statistics for our knowledge of the disease itself, particularly since he claims cannibalism and Kourou both ceased to exist within a few years after his 1957 trip. Phantom viruses transmitted through phantom cannibalism cause phantom disease. Yet Gaidashek has reshaped the thinking of an entire generation of biologists, his seductive message of slow viruses having landed on eager ears. He and the virus hunters inspired by him have built careers chasing viruses and attributing them to latent periods in order to connect them to non-infectious diseases. SMON, the nerve-destroying disease that struck Japan during the 1960s, became one unfortunate example. Japanese virologists, greatly impressed with Gaidoshuk's accomplishments, spent years searching for slow viruses they presumed would cause the disease and thereby delayed finding the true cause, a prescribed medication. Another example of a pointless virus hunt involved diabetes. Beginning in the early 1960s, some scientists tried to blame this non-contagious syndrome on the virus that also causes mumps. The evidence has been pathetically sparse, forcing virologists to point to occasional children who become diabetic after they have also suffered mumps, or, if they really stretch their case, to argue that both mumps and diabetes become most common during the same annual season in one county of New York. Having become soldiers without a war, veteran polio virologists invaded the diabetes field as well, proposing since the early 1970s that Coxsackie viruses may cause the disease. Antibodies against several strains of these harmless viruses, first discovered as byproducts of polio research, have been found in a few diabetic children. But between 20% and 70% of young diabetics have never been infected, and the remainder have already neutralized the virus with their immune systems long before the onset of diabetes. Apparently, an equal percentage of non-diabetic children have also been infected with these Coxsackie viruses. Needless to say, none of the above viruses meets Koch's postulates for causing diabetes. Hilary Kaprowski, like Gaidoshuk, typifies the modern virus hunter. Although Kaprowski's virology career began earlier, Gaidoshuk's work helped rescue Kaprowski from the obsolescence that threatened polio researchers after the war on polio. Like so many of his colleagues, he found his newest calling in the war on AIDS. Kaprowski's work on viruses started at the Rockefeller Institute in New York. By the late 1940s, he moved across town to the Lederle Pharmaceutical Company, where he worked feverishly to develop a polio vaccine. By 1954, he had invented one, but Jonas Salk was announcing the field trials for another vaccine, and Kaprowski's already tested product was shunted aside by Salk's public acclaim. Kaprowski left Lederle in 1957 to take a position as director of the privately endowed Wistar Institute of Pennsylvania, where he began tests on humans and stepped up the campaign to get approval for his vaccine. By now, Albert Sabin had tested his own polio immunization on millions of people in foreign countries, completely overshadowing Kaprowski's equally successful but less promoted vaccine. Nevertheless, Kaprowski's day did arrive. His vaccine became the standard used by the World Health Organization in America during the late 1950s and 1960s. In the meantime, he spent several years studying the rabies virus and creating a vaccine against that virus, which attacks the brain and nervous system. But because rabies is relatively rare, Kaprowski's vaccine never achieved the stardom of other immunizations. More important, however, his rabies research placed him squarely in the field of neurological diseases just in time to meet up with Gaidoshuk's Kuru work. The news of slow viruses enticed Kaprowski with visions of groundbreaking science. He quickly realized that the notion of slow viruses could become a useful tool, allowing him to source slow, non-infectious diseases to viruses so long believed to be fast-acting agents. He participated as a program advisor in Gaidoshuk's first major conference on slow and unconventional viruses held in 1964 at the NIH headquarters in Bethesda, Maryland. From that point forward, Hilary Kaprowski joined the new virus-hunting trend from which he would never turn back. His first big opportunity to take a crack at slow viruses came at the end of the 1960s. Subacute sclerosing panencephalitis, SSPE, a mouthful of a name for such a rare condition, attacks a small number of school children and teenagers each year, causing dementia, learning disabilities, and finally, death. Doctors first recognized SSPE in the 1930s, and by the 1960s, the virus hunters were searching for an SSPE germ. At that time, the most fashionable viruses for research belonged to the myxovirus family, which included the viruses that caused influenza, measles, and mumps. Animal virologists therefore started by probing for signs of myxoviruses. Excitement mounted after trace quantities of measles virus were detected in the brains of SSPE patients, and in 1967, most of the victims were found to have antibodies against measles. The facts that SSPE affected only one of every million measles-infected people and that this rare condition appeared from 1 to 10 years after infection by measles were no longer a problem. Researchers simply hypothesized a 1 to 10 year latency period. Little wonder they could also easily rationalize that one virus could cause two totally different diseases. Kaprowski's foray into SSPE research began in the early 1970s. He began isolating the measles virus from dying SSPE victims, a nearly impossible task because their immune systems had long before completely neutralized the virus. Some SSPE cases, moreover, had never had measles, merely the measles vaccine. His characteristic patience nonetheless paid off, yielding a tiny handful of virus particles from some patients that could be coaxed to begin growing again, if only in laboratory cell culture. In other patients, only defective viruses that were unable to grow had remained so many years after the original measles infection. Rather than concluding the measles virus had nothing to do with SSPE, he employed the new logic of virus hunting to argue that a defective measles virus caused SSPE. Kaprowski continued this line of SSPE research for several more years. But in 1985, Gadoshek himself entered the SSPE fray, publishing a paper with leading AIDS researcher Robert Gallo in which they proposed that HIV, the supposed AIDS virus, caused SSPE while remaining latent. With hardly a blink, several leading virologists jettisoned the old measles SSPE hypothesis in favor of a newly popular but equally innocent virus. Multiple sclerosis, MS, the notorious disease that also attacks the nervous system and ultimately kills, has provided yet another opportunity for the virus hunters. First, they blamed the measles virus starting in the 1960s, since many MS patients had antibodies against the virus. 10 years later, others suggested the mumps virus, which is similar to measles. The early 1980s brought the coronavirus hypothesis of MS, the category of virus better known for causing some colds. In 1985, with Gadoshek stealing his thunder for SSPE, Kaprowski also published a scientific paper that year in Nature with Robert Gallo, in this case arguing that some virus similar to HIV now caused MS. Unfortunately for Kaprowski, even this hypothesis was abandoned within just a few years. Phantom viruses and big bucks. Most virus hunters prefer chasing real, if arguably harmless, viruses as their deadly enemies. But Gaidashik's unconventional viruses, the ones neither he nor anyone else have ever found, have been making a comeback in recent years. Given the abundance of research dollars being poured into biomedical science by the NIH and other agencies, opportunistic virus hunters have been finding creative ways to cash in. One increasingly successful method utilizes modern biotechnology to isolate viruses that may not even exist. Hepatitis, or liver disease, has yielded profitable virus hunting opportunities in recent years. Hepatitis can be a truly painful affliction, starting like a flu but progressing to more severe symptoms, including high fevers and yellow skin. At least three varieties seem to exist. Hepatitis A is infectious, spread through unsanitary conditions, and is caused by a conventional virus. Hepatitis B also results from a virus discovered in the 1960s and is transmitted mostly between heroin addicts sharing needles, among sexually active and promiscuous people, or in the third world from mothers to their children around the time of birth. A third type of hepatitis was found in the 1970s, again restricted to heroin addicts, alcoholics, and patients who have received blood transfusions. Most scientists assume these cases were either hepatitis A or B until widespread testing revealed neither virus in the victims. Roughly 35,000 Americans die each year of any type of the disease. A fraction of those from this non-A, non-B hepatitis, as it was known for years. Today it is called hepatitis C. This form of hepatitis does not behave as an infectious disease, for it rigidly confines itself to people in well-defined risk groups rather than spreading to larger populations or even to the doctors treating hepatitis patients. Yet virologists have been eyeing the disease from the beginning, hoping one day to find a virus causing it. That day arrived in 1987. The laboratory for the job was no less than the research facility of the Sharon Corporation, a biotechnology company located directly across the bay from San Francisco. Equipped with the most advanced techniques, a research team started its search in 1982 by injecting blood from patients into chimpanzees. None of the monkeys contracted hepatitis, although subtle signs vaguely resembling infection or reddening did appear. For the next step, the scientists probed liver tissue for a virus. None could be found. Growing desperate, the team fished even for the smallest print of a virus, finally coming across and greatly amplifying a small piece of genetic information encoded in a molecule known as ribonucleic acid, RNA, that did not seem to belong in the host genetic code. This fragment of presumably foreign RNA, the researchers assumed, must be the genetic information of some undetected virus. Whatever it was, liver tissue contains it only in barely detectable amounts. Only about half of all hepatitis C patients contain the rare foreign RNA. And in those who contain it, there is only one RNA molecule for every 10 liver cells, hardly a plausible cause for disease. The Chiron team used newly available technology to reconstruct pieces of the mystery virus. Now they could test patients for antibodies against this hypothetical virus and soon discovered that only a slight majority of hepatitis C patients had any evidence of these antibodies in their blood. Koch's first postulate, of course, demands that a truly harmful virus be found in huge quantities in every single patient. His second postulate requires that the virus particles be isolated and grown, although the supposed hepatitis virus has never been found intact. And the third postulate insists that newly infected animals, such as chimpanzees, should get the disease when injected with the virus. This hypothetical microbe fails all three tests, but Koch's standards were the furthest thing from the minds of the Chiron scientists when they announced in 1987 that they had finally found the hepatitis C virus. Now more paradoxes are confronting the viral hypothesis. Huge numbers of people testing positive for the hypothetical hepatitis C virus never develop any symptoms of the disease, even though the virus is no less active in their bodies than in hepatitis patients. And according to a recent large-scale study of people watched for 18 years, those with signs of infection live just as long as those without. Despite these facts, scientists defend their still elusive virus by giving it an undefined latent period extending into decades. Paradoxes like these no longer faze the virus-hunting research establishment. Indeed, rewards are generally showered upon any new virus hypothesis, no matter how bizarre. Chiron did not spend 5 years creating its own virus for nothing. Having patented the test for the virus, the company put it into production and began a publicity campaign to win powerful allies. The first step was a paper published in Science, the world's most popular science magazine, edited by Dan Koshland Jr., professor of molecular and cell biology at the University of California at Berkeley. Edward Penhote, chief executive officer for Chiron, also holds a position as professor of molecular and cell biology at the University of California at Berkeley. The NIH-supported virology establishment soon lent the full weight of its credibility to the hepatitis C virus camp. As Chiron's CEO boasted, "We have a blockbuster product." A regulatory order from the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, to test the blood supply would reap enormous sales for Chiron. Their big chance presented itself in late 1988 as a special request from Japanese Emperor Hirohito's doctors. The monarch was dying and constantly needed blood transfusions. Could Chiron provide a test to make sure he received no blood tainted with hepatitis C? The biotech company jumped at the opportunity, making for itself such a name in Japan that the Tokyo government gave the product its approval within 1 year. The emperor died in the meantime, but excitement over Chiron's test was fueled when the Japanese government placed hepatitis C high on its medical priority list. Chiron's test kit now earns some $60 million annually in that country alone. By the middle of 1990, the United States followed suit. The FDA not only approved the test, but even recommended the universal testing of donated blood. The American Association of Blood Banks followed suit by mandating the $5 test for all 12 million blood donations made each year in this country, raking in another $60 million annually for Chiron while raising the nation's medical costs that much more. And all this testing is being done for a virus that has never been isolated. Profits from the test kit have generated another all-too-common part of virus hunting. With Chiron's new income from the hepatitis C test, Penhoat's company bought out Cetus, another biotech company founded by Donald Glaser, who, like Penhoat, also holds a position as professor of molecular and cell biology at the University of California at Berkeley. And Chiron made an unrestricted donation of about $2 million to the Department of Molecular and Cell Biology at the University of California at Berkeley that generates $100,000 in interest each year. Unfortunately for Peter Duisberg, who belongs to the same department, his supervisor is yet another professor who consults for Chiron Corporation and displays little sympathy for Duisberg for challenging modern virus hunting by restricting his academic duties to undergraduate student teaching and by not appointing him to decision-making committees. Such conflicts of interest have become standard fixtures in university biology departments. The modern biomedical research establishment differs radically from any previous scientific program in history. Driven by vast infusions of federal and commercial money, it has grown into an enormous and powerful bureaucracy that greatly amplifies its successes and mistakes, all the while stifling dissent. Such a process can no longer be called science, which by definition depends on self-correction by internal challenge and debate. Despite their popularity among scientists and their companies, latent, slow, and defective viruses have achieved only little prominence as hypothetical causes of degenerative diseases before the AIDS era. Their hypothetical role in degenerative diseases, which result from the loss of large numbers of cells, remained confined to rare, exclusive illnesses like Kuru and hepatitis C. However, because latent, slow, and defective viruses cannot kill cells, such viruses eventually achieved prominence as hypothetical causes of cancer and thus entered the courts of healthcare and medical research. The next chapter describes the terms under which these viruses were promoted as causes of cancer and how some of these terms were eventually used to promote latent, slow, and defective viruses as causes of degenerative diseases, including, above all, AIDS.